Are you a woman who seems completely put together but doesn't actually feel that way? Meet Emily and Stassi, two Columbia-trained psychotherapists and self-identified people pleasers in recovery who are reviewing their favorite books, self-help tips, and discussing their experiences of being and counseling women in the world. You'll gain a new perspective about how you're functioning and get practical steps to get out of your comfort zone to cultivate the life you really want to be living.
All right, friends, welcome back. We have a really special guest with us today. We are so excited to talk to Talia Bambola, the confidence and assertiveness specialist.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm just going to go ahead and read your bio and give our listeners a sense of who you are. And then we have some questions for you. So Talia Bambola, the confidence and assertive specialist, she's an LMFT and clinical supervisor. She is the winner of Newport Beach's Best Psychotherapist Award for 2022. Amazing. Talia is the CEO and founder of Newport Counseling Center for Individual Couples and Family Therapy, Inc. She holds a master's degree in clinical psychology with an emphasis in marriage and family therapy. Talia is a certified psychodynamic psychotherapist. She received an additional year of training in infant, child, and adolescent psychoanalytic psychotherapy and is currently in couples psychoanalytic training, both through Newport Psychoanalytic Institute. Wow. Talia also hosts Heal Through Humor and is the co-host of the Couples Guide podcast, as well as Between Two Clinicians podcast. Amazing.
I can go. It's so weird here. It's like being sung happy birthday.
Every guest I go, that's quite a resume. But what I said off camera was, you are so busy.
I think it's so well oiled at this point and very systematized. What used to feel so chaotically busy, which PS back then I loved, definitely was in my boss babe era for many reasons. And now everything has softened and it's all structured and it's been in place for so many years that it actually doesn't feel overwhelming. So I have a pretty hard and fast rule with myself. If anything is too dysregulating to my nervous system, it's got to go.
Yeah. And that's who our audience is, right? It's overfunctioning, rushing women who do it all, are super ambitious, can add more to their plate or can see other like goals in front of them and want to accomplish more. And the three of us are in that category. Yes. And so what I've done is try really hard to pull back and put boundaries with myself. So, okay, you see that goal there, but you need to like pause here and figure out how to make that. Yeah. Because my default functioning is to sprint and rush and move too quickly through life and just like not focus on anything that actually is fueling or giving. And yeah, eventually you hit a wall in adulthood where you can't be a 20-something boss babe. And all of a sudden you go, wait, I like want to live and hang out with my husband and have my family. And I think you're probably talking a little bit about that. Like that somehow happened for you.
Yeah. So my journey, I think, probably is similar to other people's. I have a medical aspect of it as well that I actually didn't realize until the last year, I would say, so that I can talk. I haven't talked about that yet on a podcast because it's like new, but for many years, so I never knew. I got diagnosed with PCOS this past year and I never knew I had that because I had been on birth control for over 15 years. I get a lot of Botox, so I don't look anywhere near the actual age that I am. So I've been on it for 15, I was on it for over 15, 14 years. And I was doing a quantum healing hypnosis session. And it came through in that session of get the birth control out. And I got it out last May. And it's just been like, honestly, a nightmare ever since. And I did not realize how much my hormones, I knew I had high testosterone, which is very much so that drive function. I've known that for a long time, but I never knew how long this was going on for and how much the birth control was masking and almost like chemically castrating any of my femininity and supporting my ability to be ruthless, to be emotionless, to be the boss babe and grow everything. Because by all means, I was functioning much more in the quote unquote masculine energy. But if you look at it hormonally, it's similar to how people who identify as women post-menopause. that like that was the same levels of structure where I could be hyper focused and driven, and I didn't have those mood swings and the luteal in this phase, and what I didn't have my cycle for over 14 years. So for me, why I resonate so much with that retired boss babe culture is I literally, on my hormonal system now, naturally, it's so out of whack. I can't do it anymore. And for so long, over a decade and a half, that's all I knew. I didn't know anything else until I stopped it. And I honestly don't think I could have built all of it had I felt like I do the last year at all. I feel that week to week shift that I think many women have felt, but there's this overfunctioning. And to your point before we got on air, like with Emily's clients, if it from a trauma response that we're overfunctioning, or your point, Stassi, is it the societal conditioning that we're overfunctioning? And I think I have that blend of both. We all overfunction if we're that type of boss babe for a reason. Be curious about the root cause of it. Is it, I look at it from like low self-worth, low self-esteem, as well as maybe having hormonal differences that make you more apt. So I could take it both ways, but I usually go the whole self-worth, self-esteem piece. Who are you trying to prove this to? For what? And when will it be enough? Like, when is enough enough? And I'm at that point now where I've accomplished every goal I've set out. And the motivation to continue is much different when it's not, you must do this or you will starve or be on food stamps or continue to be on, like, when all of your needs are met, you have to find motivation from someplace else. And that's where I'm in this existential, like, post boss babe era. Okay, so what's my motivation now if it's not to prove everything to everyone?
Totally. Yeah, mine is so ego driven, right? And it's so hard to detangle and unpack when you've been doing it for 33 years. I start with that. I always wanted to be a good girl and follow the rules. So I've done what I'm supposed to do and I've checked those boxes. So I went after following all the rules through high school, then I went to college, and after college, I went and got a master's degree, and then I fell in love, and then I got married, and then I just had a kid, right? Check, did all the good girl things I'm supposed to do. And then you wake up and go, wait a second, is this what I wanted or is this what I was supposed to do? And I genuinely don't know and can't unpack this. And we just recorded a podcast like 2 days ago, and I'm pretty sure I said the exact same thing on the other one, right? It is so ingrained, and it's ego driven, and I need to continue to be this good girl and do what I'm supposed to do and do it so well that everyone else is like in awe of how amazing I'm good and how good I am at it. That's where mine really sits. That's the other thing. Fun fact, listeners, if you want to know, I have a family. I have a twin brother and I have three siblings. So there's four of us in the family. And so I didn't get that much attention in my home. And so I got it from being the most pleasant and goodest girl in school. And I got a lot of attention for it there. And so it's a potentially minor trauma response, but that's the drive there, right? Is getting your self-worth and attention. That's how I got the praise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think looking at it from more of a behavioral perspective, and this is true when we look at like applied behavioral analysis, as human beings, we each do a certain behavior for one of four reasons. So it's like the acronym is SEAT. Sensory, we do it because it feels good. E, escape or avoidance. So I leave the dishes in the sink and somebody just has to walk past and get pissed off enough after 2 to 3 days, they go in and rescue me from it. So I'm like, sweet, I just have to wait that amount of time. Attention or connection, depending on which way you want to lean, is the A part of the acronym. And then T, something tangible. We all go to work. We all make money. No matter how much we loved our jobs, I would argue at a certain point, if you weren't being able to sustain your life or livelihood with it, you don't get that tangible thing anymore. You stop doing it. So once you learn, I'm like part neuroscience, part psychoanalyst when it comes to that. Once you learn why people do what they do, in the literal sense of what function is it serving, as well as where did this come from? What is this archetypal connection potentially? Where does this stem from in childhood? And walking them the middle path between those two is where I would say I like, that's the sweet spot of it. What's the function and purpose of it to get attention? Okay, now that you've garnished it, do we really need to continue on? If yes, for what purpose? Where does this tie into in the exploration? And if no, who are you going to be? And that's often that existential exploration. Who am I if I'm not proving my worth through productivity? And many women that I work with are like, shit, am I allowed to curse on your podcast?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Shit, I've never thought about that before. And I'm like, we need to explore that before we put out a roadmap for like how to retire as a boss babe. And then you arrive at it, you're like, I wasn't ready for this. You have to plan for retirement. That's what we call it.
First of all, I just want to laugh because everyone asks us if they can swear on this podcast, and the title is Emotionally Unfucked. And I'm like, yes.
That's so right. That's such a good point. I didn't even think of that.
Shit, no, actually.
You can't actually.
And also, like, what you're getting at, it sounds like that's a common kind of theme that you work through with different clients. And we talk about that all the time, as far as it seems like sometimes people hit this final stop where they have met all these goals along the way. And then there is this existential sort of crisis moment of what now? There's some kind of a goal that for many people, whether it is getting married or getting that degree or making this amount of money, that once someone has that and realizes that whatever they thought it was going to solve is still, they still feel the same way.
They're still themselves, and they have to live with themselves. And what version of the self are you not left with, abandoned and sitting there, no one's with me, but what version of yourself are you? And if, and I know for myself, I went through a really rough adolescence. And there were many times where I didn't even think I would make it out alive for whatever on my own doing or traumas that I had lived through. And now on the other side of that, nobody would ever guess what I had been through. And that's not like a flex, but like, really it's a 180 difference. No one would ever guess it. I had so much to prove to myself and to others. And then once that chapter closed, I'm left with a self that I love very deeply on many levels. Yet I still have this awareness and insight and desire to know and learn more. I don't think we'd be in the clinical position if we weren't able to sit and tolerate that and help others with that. So in many ways, what helps the professional growth can also almost be like this daunting, suffocating feeling in the personal growth. Cause it's like, when is enough? Like, I think I know and I'm good. I could take a break on the self-development for a little while and still be miles ahead of my previous self. Who's, you're fine. You don't have to read any more books. It's going to be okay. You already know too much. Can I unknow some things? That would be great.
So great. I actually, like, quietly as you were talking was like, starting to scan your bio, being like, what training is she doing right now? And I was like, let me go figure out what that is.
I can't not do. And I think this is to the blend of what the both of you are working on in your specializations, chicken or the egg, whether it's societal conditioning, a trauma response, it's nature and nurture in the same timing. Because when we go through certain societal conditions or family system conditions, that does start pruning our neuroscience and our own individual biochemistry to be a certain way. And we get dopamine responses and drives from certain behaviors. And that is whether it's to overcome trauma or I'm so busy and I'm going to be hyper functioning because my nervous system is now like an object in motion, it's just got to stay in motion. Or I derive self-worth from it and I've been given attention and connection and all these things I crave deeply from my childhood or the repetition compulsion from a wounded first relationship. And it's all and then some. It's not just one or the other, but we look to that to be like, how can I be productive? How can I be of service? What can I do that's of use to the people around me? And even if the behavior doesn't change, we could potentially change what we're like, what the point of seeking it out via that behavior would be. And what I mean by that is, even if you are being very productive, can we tie it to a different goal? If we can't curb the productiveness, fine, I'll let you have your drug of choice. I would like you to tie it to a new meaning where it is more self-fulfilling rather than only in service of others. Can we add something on this to-do list where you're at the top rather than how accomplished you are or what have you?
Totally. And we've been following each other for a little while now. And I was on your podcast a couple weeks ago. And one of my favorite reels you've done, I don't think it's a repeat one. I think it's a new one is, and I like DM'd you was like, this is perfect. But it's about resting, right? Like what is it rest? And I would love, we'll share it on our page. But one of the things Emily wrote down the quote, which was, how can I make more rest more productive? What else could I do while I'm resting? This is, and then you said, this is a surefire way to burnout. And if I can slow that down for a second, clients are doing this all the time, right? They like can't sit on the couch. They feel anxious and need to go sweep. They need to go do the dishes. They need to go do something. And what you're adding is like, maybe someone actually got to the couch. They finally got to the couch and like, okay, I'm going to sit here. But what happens is the nervous system can't sit still. And so it starts pinging up all sorts of either ideas or just energy saying, it's not comfortable to sit here. It's not safe. We need to keep you moving because there's a tiger in the room and you need to get out of here. And so what that little tag is, how can I make this more productive, is trying to settle your nervous system so you're allowed to sit. Can you talk more about what inspired that post? It's so good. I was like literally screaming in my house being like, that's like the best one.
I would say years of my own therapy inspired that and my own personal life. I call it productivity guilt, which you can slice it any way you want, but it's, I feel guilty when I'm not being productive. And namely, most of the women I work with, it's because self-worth is tied to productivity. So there's a threat. There really is a threat to the nervous system, real or perceived, because I'm not doing, I'm not being of service. I'm not having anything to look at externally to allow myself to have earned the rest. This could be due to one of a few factors at minimum. You grew up in a very busy household and that was the norm. You prefer, like you're saying, to have that because your body does feel like there's a lion in the room when there's not. And that would be a strong case for including more meditative practices, more energy work, Reiki, something that's internal, far beyond transcending talk therapy, to work on those ancestral wounds and that almost that fight or flight system on overdrive, the part of your nervous system that's designed to regulate all the way to calm you clearly hasn't been tended to. And it's your job or any individual's job as an adult to learn how to do that. So I would say it's societal productivity guilt. And it's also the messaging we received and being a stay-at-home parent, that is often the messaging that is received. What did you do all day? Excuse me? What didn't I do is the shorter list. And then it becomes this kind of couples problem. But even for people who don't have kids and they are trying to just rest at the end of a long day, they're boss babes. They want to just chill on the couch. I made that post because it does resonate for so many people, myself included. And it really wasn't until learning what it was like to sit with myself and love myself wholly, not like religiously, but wholly in a whole sense, that I liked to be by myself. I looked forward to resting and not making it more productive. And I had to actively practice the thought and belief, this is okay. There's nothing wrong with taking time to rest. There is no need to be feeling guilty. I have not done anything in lack of accordance to my standards, maybe some weird societal standard, but society's not in my living room with me right now. And this can be enough. This is enough as it is. I am enough as I am, and I'm allowed to rest without feeling guilty for it. And I think working on having that as a mantra and reintegrating that, if it was been ever lost, as a core belief, is the key to stopping that productivity guilt. You have to make it an active practice to ameliorate the guilt and to work on that mantra. I do not need to feel guilty for this. I have done more than most people will ever do in their lifetime. And that's not to say it like an ego way. I really can. I can look at my website and be like, that's enough. Like, you're done. You actually don't need to do anything else and you will be totally fine. And that also gives me a nice break, is like looking at those things or looking at vision boards of things that have come true and been like, yeah, we're just going to coast this year. It's totally fine. You can rest. Nothing's going to blow up. The world's not going to end. In fact, you might even like yourself more and rest more. And then that's what I'm exploring in my own analysis now. Like, how do I soften into this and settle into that more evolved, I like to call like the feminine energy, or that like flow side where it feels comfortable to just be and not have to do.
Let me ask you a question. You brought up the repetition principle, and I know that you're psychoanalytic. So I have a question for you about how all this relates to the repetition principle and like core beliefs.
So I like to mix in this to answer why it's a repetition or repetition compulsion in this case. Part of it is ancestral. And I don't know if either of you have read the book, It Didn't Start With You by Mark Wollin, about intergenerational trauma. So part of it may stem from that. And then it's an underlying core belief. And depending on what stress hormones you were exposed to in utero as well, that can have a large indication of what your comfort and tolerance level are with being at rest or not at rest. We're still sensitive, more than most people think, I think, during that developmental time. So the repetition compulsion becomes, I need to do, I need to recapitulate some part of my childhood, whether it was myself deriving worth from my parents praising me for being productive, getting all my chores done, being accomplished. I remember personally being lauded for getting all of my spelling books done in the carpool because my brother and I had a different carpool. He's a bit older. But so we'd go through, I'd get a snack, and then we'd go back through again and pick him up and go home. And other people, all the families would share. And other families would be like, oh, she did this. And I remember feeling good. And it does tie to that inherent good. And when we look at Erikson's psychosocial stages of development, beyond trust and mistrust is autonomy versus shame and doubt. So if you were praised, if you accomplished autonomy as a core goal or core value, like a milestone, wonderful. If you were praised for it, double the effect that you're going to be likely to seek that out as you move through the other developmental phases. And if you don't, then you internalize this shame and doubt. And that can also spurn you into wanting to prove yourself for the rest of your life. So it's like this really, it's a very gentle teeter-totter that you have to be on, where it's like, how do I arrive at this virtue, but just in a virtuous way enough to not go off the deep end in one area of, I feel so ashamed, I need to prove that I'm worthy and not ashamed or doubt myself, or I loved it so much, this is the only way that I would be able to receive praise or admiration. So it becomes, to avoid rest can be from a repetition compulsion, because you may have seen in your family system or the next family, the generation above you, no one rested. So you might have internalized that lesson as well, that nobody got to rest, or you only got to rest when your work was done. And this could be, we could talk about more of the anthropology of a lot of this as well. We are in one of the first societies now where the work from home thing, especially post-COVID, is quite normal. That was unheard of many years ago, but then also the 9-to-5 thing wasn't really imposed until the last 200 years. So it can go again, both directions of, we have always valued productivity as a society, because back in the day, we didn't have a lot of technology to do the things that we needed a full team to do. And people used to have 18 to 20 kids to have farm hands because they had to do it all themselves. Like, this is so ingrained in many of us to just do and produce and be, because you would die if you didn't. And now we're at the point where you won't die if you don't, but we feel like we will.
Yeah. And I love Mark Wolin's book. A lot of people probably haven't heard of it, but it's a book about trauma and how trauma isn't just passed down through what we experience, right?
Yeah. Like
in our childhoods or lives, but in our parents' lives and previous generations. So the idea that basically trauma changes our genetic makeup and is passed down intergenerationally. And he brings up in the book that when our grandmother is pregnant with our mother, she's also housing the egg that will become us. So anything that happens from that time forward might have some kind of impact on the hormonal experience that we have pre-conception, which is really interesting to think about.
Yeah.
Super interesting. And if you want to know, we talk pretty in good length with Dr. Eric Fisher in season one about generational trauma. So we'd really explain it a lot more. So if you're a listener being like,
what the heck? Go back and listen to that episode.
Listen to that one a little bit. And hope we can, where you guys are following it. Not only is it in terms of what happens to our bodies and all those pieces, but for instance, we were talking about like addiction runs in my family. If my grandfather's struggles with addiction and my mom witnesses that, there might be no family member within that family generation that does, but they've experienced behaviors and fear responses around that they actually treat their children in similar ways, and that can produce a very similar reaction down the ladder, and generational trauma can happen. It's like, what came first, chicken or the egg? Also, right. In terms of like behaviorist or biochemical, and we'll never get to the end of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's just too nuanced and complex, but that all those things are working together to create
a
form for sure.
Yeah.
So to pivot, if that's okay, we really wanted to know about your specialty niche. So like you call yourself the confidence and assertiveness specialist. So what does that mean to you, and how did you get into that as your niche?
What it means to me is a relatable, but not, I wouldn't say like power commanding, that's not the right word, but there's an authority to it, but a relatability to it. So I think it's like the relatable authority on two very core traits that every human being needs to have to function in themselves and to function in society. And there are two traits, they are two traits, the confidence and assertiveness are two traits that are ranked very highly when it comes to who is the most desirable as a boss, an employee, a partner, a friend, a colleague. You want to have somebody who can believe in themselves, which also means knowing where your limits are. So confidence is not arrogance. There's a big difference there. And to be able to assert yourself could also mean I'm asserting myself by not saying anything in this moment because I don't have a kind thing to say, which is different than being nice. Being nice is like people pleasing and you'll tell anybody anything that they want to hear to keep the peace. And being kind is you need to hear this. It might hurt. My intention is not for it to. I will say it as kindly as possible, but here it is. So teaching people that much of the lives they live in their head actually does need to come out loud. And many arguments are won in the shower or one afterwards. Well, then I said this and that, and I'll talk to clients. I'm like, did you actually say that? They're like, no, but I thought about saying it and I wish I could have. And I'm like, do you want to work on a skill where you actually could get that out in a different way? And they're like, yeah, for sure. I didn't even know that was an option. And this breaks both the trauma response as well as the societal conditioning that a lot of women receive of be small, be complacent, don't take up too much space, don't speak your actual needs, just basically be resentful and hope that people will read your mind and hope that, and tie to, and this goes back to our biology as well, hope that they will know without you having to ask because somehow it means more if you don't have to ask. And that relates largely to our own behaviors with our parents growing up. Like your parent is the only person as an infant who should ever be able to determine your needs without you having to ask because you don't have verbal skills. And then we just take that and project it all over in adulthood. So
it's so fun because yeah. I have a mother of a one-year-old and I promise you, I don't know his needs.
You're like, it's still not happening. But if we had
I'm trying my best, but he's telling me I'm not doing it right.
If we had a shot at it, it would be then. And so if it worked out well, we want to repeat it. And if we liked it or we lacked it from childhood, that's what I often say, we'll repeat it. And the confidence and assertiveness specialist to me is let's give a voice to that inner voice that you know you have and build and bolster your self-esteem and self-worth to have the confidence to believe in yourself and the assertiveness to stand up for yourself. Because as many of us who are therapists, we usually went through some sort of experience that inspired us. This is a very unique job that most people don't choose just on a whim, at least that I've met. I wouldn't be alive without therapy. I started in middle school because I was bullied very badly. And it was a very competitive school, I would say, that I went to academically. And now that I look back on it and have done a lot of analysis, this is not to sound arrogant by any means, I think I was very sure of myself. And I go back and watch like chit chat videos. We had to do public speaking in like second and third grade. And I was like confident, sure of myself. It's not that, but it, like I had it going and somebody saw that light. And like most adolescent girls do, they're like, you can't, if I can't have it, neither can you. And they like sucked the soul out of me like a dementor. So not only did I like know what it was like to have it, I know what it was like to get it taken away and have to claw my way back to having it. And no one is ever going to fucking take it away from me again. And that is how passionate I am about helping other women have that voice and never drown it out, no matter how loud other people's are, no matter how much they might be uncomfortable about it, your voice matters. So it's giving a voice to people who feel voiceless or giving a voice to people who know what they have to say is valuable. They just don't have the tools or the skills to get it out there. So in either direction, I love being that person who can help with the confidence and the assertiveness because they're life skills that everybody should have from a young age. And we should laud them a lot more than we give them shit for in society, in my opinion.
Totally. And when I first found you we found each other on Instagram. Yeah. And when I first found you and I read that, I went, oh my gosh, she's exactly, I DM'd you right away and I said, we have a similar vibe going on. We should connect. And what I interpreted it as was that with the clients I work with, they have a voice. They are ambitious. They're going through it. They are boss babes. They're often called bitches and are pit against so that they aren't successful. However, at home, there's still so much socialization that seeps into us as women, even when we can bend around some of the other ones that are so overt that, oh, it's not worth it to talk to my husband about this problem. It's not, I just want to keep the peace. I just want it to be pleasant. Uh-huh. I've never had a 4-day fight. I've never gone to bed angry. I'll just let it go because it's not worth it. And that is where I find the confidence and assertiveness to actually in with my clients, that's where we actually need to be sitting in, because they have assertiveness and they have confidence in so many areas. And then there's this piece that, like, I don't think they think it's not confidence. I think they think it's easier and that things are going to go away, but it doesn't go away. What you said earlier was it turns into resentment, and I went quickly, and you're scared to be a martyr, naggy, and all
want to become their mother. So that's part of it too, is let me overcorrect and develop and be the boss babe, or very, when you don't feel threatened or like the relationship is threatened, it's much easier to be assertive. Like this is, it's very ingrained in us to be like, okay, if I'm not risking that, but like your most intimate relationship is the most triggering and the most activating. First of all, because it's the most closely related to childhood, which hello, well, I'll have a job forever because everybody has a childhood to unpack. And second of all, you want to be seen a certain way. If you yourself haven't owned all of your dark parts, you definitely don't want your partner getting near them, and you don't want to be seen as too much or not enough, because behaviorally and biologically, you'd be in the social outgroup. You would die. If people didn't like you back in the day, you'd be left for dead from your tribe. That does not leave our bodies and our primal ways of being. So for those evolved and not as evolved reasons, women love being confident and assertive sometimes outside of it. And they're almost aggressive, like on the continuum of passive aggressive, assertive to aggressive. I will help rein in those people who are very resentful and can really like throw verbal punches. And I'm like, okay, but how do we get you back to the assertive midline? So it's both and on both ends of the spectrum. I don't have a voice, or I exercise it strongly and people are afraid of me. I need help getting to the middle.
I like that you clarify it that way, right? It's like a spectrum, and the kind of most productive or helpful middle is assertiveness, not aggressiveness or passive aggressiveness. I haven't ever thought about it as far as a spectrum like that, but of course that makes total sense.
It flex into it. There's times where in order to be the most effective, and I'm all in service of efficiency, in order to be the most effective and get your ideal outcome, you may have to take a more passive stance intentionally, but it's not acquiescing. And you may have to take a more aggressive stance intentionally. That doesn't need to be your primary way of relating to the world or primary way of being. If you have it within you, you can rest assured that you can activate it. So I help them develop all of those different parts so that they can access it and put it center stage if need be. But the easiest way for them to live with their nervous system is I've got my back, and I know to what degree I can flex that if I need to. And there's going to be times where I don't want to take the reins on everything, and I'm choosing the more passive and calm and relaxed route. And I then have to work with them on not fearing, because they're always like, what if nobody does all these things? I'm like, first of all, some things don't need to get done. You're just in that productivity cycle. Second of all, the goal of asking somebody for help with something or tasking them with it is not so they do it the way you want. The goal is that you don't have to do it. So you need to be okay that other people are going to have their own way of doing things. You can't control everything. And our way of seeking control is our way of trying to keep ourselves safe. So if you learn to regulate yourself and feel safe and rely upon yourself, you can also then rely on others without being reliant, or depend on others without being dependent. That's the middle ground as well, with the avoidant attached and anxious attached. That middle ground is secure. I know I can depend on people. I know I can rely on people, but I'm not beholden to only living my life and risking my independence or risking abandonment. So I work with a lot of the attachment lens as well.
Yeah. So we were curious how, I guess we've got a little bit about how that shows up with your work with women. How do you create it with couples? And
oh, with couples. Okay. So with couples, I work with various couples. Most commonly, I would say the archetypes would be the like good mother or good father archetype mixed with the like lost boy or lost child archetype. So
slow that down and name characteristics.
So when we look at like Jungian psychology, there are certain, and other types of psychology have archetypes as well. One of my favorite books, it's actually right here. It's very dense, so I don't recommend it as, oh, just pick it up casually. This is like deep analytic training. It's very thick, but it's called You're Not What I Expected by Polly Young Eisenrath. And she discusses that we, as an individual, we have this strange gender that lives inside of us, but that's also out loud in our partner. And so when we get close to that version or that person, we get locked into these what are called projective identifications, that I don't see my partner as my partner. I see them as this terrible mother. I see them as this good father. I see them as this maiden or whore lover. I see them as this lost child. And if I'm locked into that and I'm not aware of how much I'm projecting, or my partner is linking with that and identifying with the projection, couples get so caught up in these really negative and unnecessary, frankly, patterns. I say that being in my position, obviously, I think they're quite necessary to the people at the times because clearly they're functioning with them, but they're not aware of how much they're getting caught up in projections or projective identification. So how the confidence and assertiveness shows up in couples work is mostly psychoanalytic, I would say, to give them the voice of, you need to be able to lean in with your partner and say, hey, I don't think you're seeing me as me. I think you're seeing me as your dad right now. And this is like late stage work. I'm not saying you lead with this. Like, I think you're seeing me as your dad. And what do you need? Or what are you projecting? How can I help catch you with what you're projecting onto me? What are you afraid of? If you're afraid of having your parents' marriage, then we do need to be treating each other differently. So it's speaking into not only like that psychoanalytic work. I'm really big into behavioral neuroscience and biology. And one of my favorite, I don't have the other one with me, but the other favorite book I like is The Female Brain by Lou Anne Brizendine. And she discusses just how much estrogen and testosterone act on us to be pretty much, we're the same species, but we are very different when it comes to our approaches to communication and connection in so many different ways. So I work with couples to help them understand, don't expect them to be like you, and do not expect them to read your mind. Like commandment number one, we are going to voice every expectation, i.e. projective identification, out loud of these archetypes. When you do this, I see you as this strong, sexy man who I want to be with. And I hope you can be like that all the time, but I never tell you because if I don't tell you, then it means more. And if it means more, then I can love you more. And there's all these fantastical delusions that act upon us that we get from childhood, archetypal conditioning, and movies and rom-coms too. So it's not always this deep-seated therapeutic thing. Sometimes it's just, I watched too many of those movies growing up and I was under the impression that love was whatever it was on the movies and TV shows. And that's really all I had to look forward to because my family of origin really fucked me up when it came to what love looked like. So I'll look to that instead. And now I'm finding myself somewhere in the middle, very disappointed. Help. So I help them be real.
It's a healing fantasy to say.
For sure.
I didn't see healthy love modeled to me, but I'm going to see it on Disney, like, for what I think healthy love is. And now I'm projecting that unrealistic standard. And now I'm unhappy. That is.
Your partner identifies with any part of it, they will link up with it. I guess I am a terrible partner then, like these defensive responses. I'm just an idiot. I'm just an asshole. I'm so incompetent. I'm so incapable. And we're not, as this is more the biological side, we're not motivated by the same things by any means. Women are more motivated by criticism because we don't want to die, i.e. we want to be good and do good and be chosen, etc., because it furthers our species and survival up here. So we are motivated by criticism, and we mistakenly think that men are motivated by the same thing. So we criticize them into being how we want them to be, but it makes them, the part of their brain that shifts on is defensiveness and anger. And then they shut down and they don't want to deal with it and they don't like being criticized. And we need to learn linguistically how to shift the way we motivate people and really behaviorally condition people to get more of what we both want. So I'm all a fan of using, and I say manipulation, and like I push on one variable in hopes of getting another. That's how I define it. I'm a big fan of manipulating the situation with your partner in terms of both of you getting everything that you want and more. Use your words, like let them know what would help them to win, and not by way of criticism, because you want to avoid that projection of the terrible mother or the really like hard ass father or whatever it might be. So I try to link in these two worlds of neuroscience and psychoanalysis.
Fascinating. So like a pro tip, don't lead with you're being your dad, but right.
You're giving me really big dad vibes right now. No, it's hearing your partner out and taking, and I have couples put one hand on their heart and one hand on their stomach when their partner's talking and taking a really deep breath. Eye contact is mixed because men like doing activities side by side. They face their enemies. That's why it's called facing your enemies. So eye contact can be very foreboding for men in a conversation, but we are like, if you're not paying attention to us, we're going to die. Give me your eye contact. And then for guys, they're like, oh, this is a lot. They're like, you always do this. You always abandon me in my time of me. You can't even look at me. No, because you're not an enemy. So sit side by side and look at something or go on a walk. That's the best thing to do to regulate, and put your hand on your chest and your stomach. And if you're noticing your partner's having a really strong activation, or they're trying to invite you into an identification, is what I say, understand and tell yourself, this is not a me thing. I have not done what they've said I've done. And this is not, you don't say this out loud. This is their own stuff. And my job as their partner right now is to be their witness and mirror back to them, or contain the space and then give it back to them and say, okay, how can I best support you? Validation, empathy, all of those basic skills. This sounds like a lot. I'd love to know my part in this. I'm curious. I'm this, rather than hearing it and being like, I have to defend myself. We like this adversarial stance that you can actually break out of if you understand it's not about you. Like, the only person who is as important to you as you are to you is you. You are the center of your own universe. We're all very ego driven. And when you can transcend that and understand partnership is two-ness, it's not oneness and the other person just reanimates when you're around them. It's two people building one life. You don't want to get along all the time. You don't want to. I would drive myself fucking nuts if I dated myself. Good night. I would be out. I'd be like, this date is over with. You want somebody different, yet you punish them when they're so different from you because you like the way that you do things. You got to work on yourself at the same time as you're working on your couple relationship. So, that would be my best advice too. They're not there for you. They're there with you. Yeah.
Good stuff. It's funny. One, I mean, I have so many thoughts and I'm like trying to organize them and figure out what I want to say with it. And it's so funny because when I was in couples counseling with my husband, I also realized how like different we do communicate. And I already knew that was not like a huge surprise, but if he was talking to the therapist, he'd leave out so much detail and so much things that you're like, this story doesn't make sense. Like, she has to have so much
detail. Yeah. Yeah.
This doesn't make any sense. And then I like got really scared about sending him off to therapy by himself, being like, what would you talk about if I wasn't there to rescue you, to give in the detail? Like, what insight could you ever have?
There's that product, right? What's the purpose and the meaning, and the purpose of details widely varies. What's the intent? Why do I need these? It's not what we often think. You're missing it. You're missing my side. I will never know the full truth because I don't live with you. Thank God I don't live with every couple I work with. That would be A, very expensive, and B, very weird, because we need some sense of normalcy. And like, we don't want our couples therapist to see everything, nor do we want our partner to see everything. But there's also a difference of what's helpful. Talk therapy, very helpful for me for certain topics. For others, I don't want to talk about it. I want to feel into it. It's somatic work. It's Reiki. It's going to the gym. It's being with a friend and of consciously avoiding talking about it just so I can understand and frame it differently. And not every couple gets along with what would be helpful either. So it's just, hey, I'd love for you to do some individual work. Whatever that looks like for you, please start doing it, because I need you to be more in touch with yourself, even without it being therapy. So I think even like keeping the suggestions open, but also sharing the fear. If this is what it's like with us, what, like, curious, like, what is it like in your own therapy? What do you talk about? Okay. Or if you ever want to share, I'm down to hear it. But that goes back to being my biggest thing that I definitely wanted to make sure we talked about today in terms of couples, is the concept of being a safe person to tell the truth to. The way that we function in society, or how we show our status, is how much do I know and who thinks I'm important? And so you can't get rid of me in like the group or the tribe, essentially, primally. So I would hear something from you, Stassi, maybe, and then I'll go tell Emily, oh my gosh, you'll never tell with Stassi, blah, blah, blah. Not realizing that by way of me showing, look how important I am, that Stassi told me this big secret about her, I'm completely betraying your trust. But I'm not seeing that primarily, I'm seeing that secondarily. If I look back at it, I'm just trying to show you what status I have. Look how special I am that told me that. First of all, not helpful with women. We all know what gossip ends with. Second of all, not helpful with our romantic partner, who we worked so hard for them to even see the purpose of sharing this truth. And then we got home and we're like, so I was talking to your mom, blah, blah, blah. And the guy's, you told somebody, I told you that in confidence. And they're like, don't worry, it was just girls' lunch. And then they accuse them of never opening up again. I don't need a degree in math to add that one up. You were not a safe person to tell the truth to. They don't want to open up again. So truth as a foundation, you have to be able to hear it. You have to not have a negative reaction. Even if you don't like it, you just have to stomach it and be like, that's a lot of feelings for me to process. Thanks for sharing. And moving forward from that, not disclosing that to somebody else. Trust is built. It's built and earned, and it can go away very quickly, and it can be taken away by certain actions without us realizing it. You have to override those primal drives to desire to share the status. You have to be a safe person to tell the truth to and not have a negative reaction or try to convince them out of it. Where should we go for dinner? I was thinking this. I want to go to Mexican food. No, I don't like Mexican food. And they're like, why did I just waste my thought resources sharing this opinion with you if you're going to shoot it down? I'm not going to say anything. Enter. They never talk. They never communicate. Like, a lot of these couples' problems can be solved by going against your basic biology and like understanding, like, they're not a little you. Stop treating them like they're a clone of you. They don't know what you know yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that they're not a clone of you. They don't know what you know yet. And they don't respond to the world the way you respond or see the same thing or hear the same sentence in the same way. Yes. You do. Is so different.
Yes, it's incredibly different. And we operate, this is separate from like the reason why I bring this up is because we all come from family systems to whatever level of function or dysfunction. You get in these communication patterns and these ingrained ways of being, and you have slang, you have short talk, you have these different words and codes with your family of origin, healthy or unhealthy aside, whatever it is. And then you go into the world as you're getting older and you have friendships and relationships, and you tend to prefer things that are similar. And if they're different, they have to be different enough to spark curiosity. So you maybe have family systems where you're going over to your friend's house and they have similar stuff in the fridge, or they use similar wording to you, or they wear similar clothes or whatever else. It's a comfort thing. It's familiarity. Then you get older and you're dating and you're operating on these multi-year levels of expectations. Let's say you have your first relationship at 20. How long have you been in your family? 20 years. You're taking a 20-year script and expectation and bringing it into somebody you've just met, assuming that they grew up in this similar household, saw the world the same way, et cetera, not considering different, every family has their own culture, plus ethnic culture as well. You have to be curious. And I think coming from the stance of teach me what you know, teach me how you see the world is far more growth oriented than I'm going to operate on the assumption we see the world the exact same way. And people get caught up in these delusions in the beginning of dating. I don't want to see the bad. You're so hot. You're so whatever. You're my ticket out of here. I don't want to ruin that by seeing the real you. That's no fun. I just want to project on you.
And they get really insecure when you see it differently. Like that, all of a sudden that means we're not compatible, that we don't see it the same way. Right. And that's the other big risk there, right? We live in a global world now. There's no way that we have the same. I am actually shocked. I'm from Oregon. My husband's from New Jersey. And he'll talk about his school lunches. And I'm like, wait, we have the same school lunches? Like, how is that? I didn't know that. Like, what? The government's fucking weird that we both have the same thing on the same day. That's so weird. And look, that's unique to the United States probably, but like we live in this very global scale where we really do need to assume there's differences and be curious about that, and instead of assuming that the similarities are more common. And that's an insecurity. It's not, it's a strength, I think.
So would you say that part of confidence and assertiveness therefore is the ability to step back and just accept that people are different from us and being open to learning about those differences?
Yeah, I think the intersection would be tolerance. And the definition I use for tolerance in this case is to interact with and still have respect for. So I would say the intersection of being truly confident in yourself and assertive enough to stand up for yourself or other people and give a voice to what you might be seeing that's happening is being able to tolerate, being able to interact with other people, still have respect. It doesn't mean you have to like the person. It doesn't mean you have to continue to interact with them. That's not it either. It's really being able to be in the moment, but also from a bird's eye view. Okay, what's going on here? Why am I getting triggered? Why am I getting activated? Is this about me? Nope, that's on them. Do I want to be around them? Do I want to sit with their stuff or sit with them while they're going through their stuff or not? And knowing that you don't have to save or fix or get involved with everyone. That's where Stassi was mentioning that martyr complex. a lot of people who struggle with confidence and assertiveness, if you're looking at like the Enneagram, 8 is the number, the challenger leader. Shocking, no one, I'm an 8. But the counterpart is the 2. So when 2s are the helper giver, when they're growing towards health, they move towards an 8. So I did this by design, and a lot of my marketing and writing, it's not like manipulatively, but I want to speak to people who want to grow to that direction. I just happen to have that natural gift skill set. Why not, like Rainbow Fish, that children's book? I would like to give out a shiny scale so everybody in the world can have more of what I have innately. Like, I'm not gatekeeping it. So I think it's looking at it from that perspective. The cross section is, how do you help and give in without over functioning in a way that empowers both people and that you can still have tolerance?
It's so funny. I'm like so attracted to 8s in my life. Like, my husband's an 8. Multiple of my friends are 8. And I think it's because that was like part of what I needed to grow. And it's exactly what you're saying. And I think the best like therapeutic matches oftentimes are therapists who, yeah, can help a client get to a point of growth that they maybe achieved or already naturally had.
Yeah.
Love it all the time. Wow.
This has been so fun.
I agree. I can talk for hours, so I can come back if you need me to. I can write something up if you need me to.
We would love that. We want to have you back. We want to have you back.
We'd love to have you back. We'd love to ask our listener questions and have you come back and answer some of their questions. It's so fun for us. And you have such an audience that I'm sure they always have questions for you, but we can do that on here, which would be super fun. Yeah, Emily, you had something to say. Sorry.
No, that's it. Just, we would love to have you back and pose some questions out there if you're up for it.
I love answering questions. I'm quite the nerd in that sense, so I'm happy to answer anything I can. And if not, I will go down a rabbit hole of research and give you articles. That's my brand.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you want our listeners to know? Again, speaking to like high achieving women doing it all, is there anything else that you feel like we didn't touch upon that our listeners would resonate with?
Ooh, good question. It doesn't have to be the way it is now for the rest of your life. And whether that excites you or makes you afraid, that sentiment, you're in the right place. So I really believe in honoring people where they are at. And if you want to change the way that you are, like, even if you love all that you do and you're like really still wanting to be hyperproductive, I'm not shaming people for that. I'm not saying stop being hyperproductive. Just be like I call it from like Boss Babe to Burrito Babe is one of the programs that I run on the back end. Like, the goal is everybody come Burrito Babes. If you don't want to be a Burrito Babe yet, that's okay. I'm not shaming you by any means. Let's figure out why. Let's figure out what is the most productive and the most useful from it. And then let's see if we can offload some stuff so you can just keep all the things that bring you joy. And if you're on the other end of the spectrum and you're like, I'm so over it, I'm tired, I don't want to do this anymore, know that help is out there for you and that you don't have to overfunction as a way of survival. We're far beyond that as a species in many cases. So let's regulate your nervous system and get some new beliefs online to make sure that you can live your life the way that you want to live it, not the way that you expect everybody else, including former you, to have to live a certain way. So that would be my existential yet optimistic message to send out there, and that healing is possible and you can figure out a way through it that doesn't involve burning yourself out or burning yourself as like a candle at both ends. Like, you just want to be like one end, shine bright as the light for people.
Yeah, the both and situation.
Yes.
Please tell our listeners where they can find you and all your info.
Yes. So you can find me on Instagram mainly. I do have a TikTok now, though. My media team is helping me with that, which is cool to log in and see it grow. So both of those are at Talia Bombola, just my spelling of my name. And then for therapy, my therapy website's therapywithtalia.com. I'm on a wait list for new clients, but I do have some slots open up occasionally. And then for coaching, it's just, or like mentorship for like business, I do a lot of that for people who are like, I just want to be an achiever. I don't want to be a high achiever, overachiever. I would just like to rest on the laurels of my accomplishments. So just be an achiever. That's taliabombola.com. So yeah, I think that's Instagram. Yep, that's everything.
Perfect. And it's TaliaBombola.
Yes.
Find her everywhere social media exists besides Pinterest. and YouTube.
But I'm on YouTube. Yeah, I don't understand how that works.
I don't either. I realized as I was saying, you can find her everywhere. I was like, wait, wait, no, there's a lot of social media accounts. Just
I'm not on OnlyFans. I'm not. Just Instagram and TikTok.
Yeah. Sorry, listeners, made that confusing. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank we you.
So
I appreciate it. Thanks.
This has been Emotionally Unfucked.
Okay, guys.